Here I am in the desert again, a compass and a weapon, a lost American. I started out with a simple plan and a locket in my hand, but the sun's so unforgiving and the wind so hard to stand. Fall out with the rest of your brothers, with the rest of your sisters, the heroes on the line. And carry out what your leader says, for what his leader says is that his leader says this is right for the people. No one will ever understand why thousands of beautiful, healthy young statues must fall. Smoke and explosions surround me, a flood of hate, it drowns me. I cannot live this way, no, I cannot live with doubt and confusion. They find me, they run up right behind me. I cannot die this way. No, I cannot die this way.
Good evening and welcome to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. So glad you joined us this evening. My guest in the studio is Kathleen Berry, a sociologist and author of several books, and her most recent book is coming out very soon. So we're getting a look at it before it's actually in the bookstores. The book is called Unmaking War, Remaking Men: How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. Kathleen, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This is quite a project you've taken on.
Yes, it didn't start out as a big project in a full book. It started out as I was trying to address the question of why we talk about innocent lives being killed in war, because it occurred to me as we were hearing reports from Lebanon and from Iraq that as soon as you say some people shouldn't be killed, you've automatically said other people can be killed. Of course, our soldiers. And that just started me writing what I thought was going to be an article, and now is a book.
And I'm surprised at how easily the rest of us just slip by that concept. I mean, we're all brought up knowing thou shalt not kill. And so easily we fall into what you have just described, sorting out the people who are killable and the people who are not.
Yeah, me too. Uh-huh. I mean, it was just 4 years ago that in listening to news reports, as Israel is bombing Lebanon, and when the U.S. reports on bombings and that the U.S. doesn't do, we refer to innocent lives.
Yes.
When we do the bombings, we refer to them as collateral damage.
That's right.
And it was that repetition of that term in the news reports in that 2006 war that really grabbed me and raised this question for me and led me to the same point that you just expressed, that why haven't I thought of this before?
Yes.
So I started writing to see where it would go, and it immediately took me into the whole inevitability of war that we assume.
Yes.
Even with all of our peace movements and all of our feminist struggles,
yes,
there's an underlying assumption that we're not going to get rid of war. We just got to keep toning it down, making it less and less, pulling out here, preventing an invasion there, but not an assumption that we can really get rid of it. And I think that's underpinning. In fact, the Geneva Conventions make it an underpinning of an inevitability of war.
Yes. As I read through the book, it was a constant revelation to me. I was saying, well, yes, she's right. And I'd taken that for granted. I hadn't thought of this. You make a very, very tight case. And then, of course, you've so much research. I mean, the notes in the back are just amazing, the amount of research you've done to document. I mean, this is not just your ideas. These are well-documented events And as a sociologist, then, you bring your academic training into this and your background. And your other books have dealt with violence against women.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, in the final result, by the time you get to the conclusion of this book, you see that violence in war and violence against women are one and the same thing.
Yes.
And as I began in the research, looking into practices, strategies of the military in Afghanistan and Iraq, house clearings, and I began to look very closely at what was actually going on in the house clearings. We're doing them now in Afghanistan and calling them night raids, but they're exactly the same thing. And you see a kind of behavior of the U.S. soldiers going in to do these house clearings, supposedly looking for, quote, insurgents, which is another problematic term. You see in that the behavior that they're taught, that they're trained, the same kind of behavior that you see in men abusing women in their homes.
Yes.
And it occurred to me then, I mean, it's not a new idea that violence in war and violence against women are linked, but they're more linked, and violence against women is more determining of violence in war than I had thought about before. And I've worked on violence against women for 40 years.
Yes, and published several books on the subject. Yes. Recently, a terrible event in Congo of the rape of, I think, 26. Of course, there were probably many more than 26, but 26 were documented, of at least 26 women. It seems to me that you hit a certain level in numbers and it catches people's attention. It's as though the rape of one woman or the death of one child isn't enough to make the news. But if it's a whole village full of women, then people say this must stop.
Yeah, then it becomes mass rape and gang rape and starts to become part of either ethnic cleansing or genocidal campaigns. And in fact, the United Nations has moved on that and is taking a stronger stand, although we don't see it really turning out in changing the reality on the ground. But even that, even the rapes in the Congo and the United Nations proclamations against rape in war and the, you know, declaration prohibiting rape in war has the same problem to it that I'm addressing in this book, because it doesn't cover women soldiers. 1 in 3 American women in the U.S. military are raped or sexually harassed on base in the field.
I had no idea.
It is enormous. And that declaration that is supposed to prevent rape of the villagers that you're talking about in the Congo does not cover women in the military, because it would then be inconsistent with the Geneva Convention, which says those who are not engaged in hostilities are protected, their rights are protected. That means that those engaged in hostilities are not protected. In fact, as I show in my book, the Geneva Conventions violate the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
When I read that in your book, I was just astonished, because that was new information to me. Well, there was a lot of new information to me in this book. And of course, much of it is very difficult information for the reader to absorb, but it's so important. It is so very important. I mean, how long can we hide our heads in the sand and say, well, this is just simply too much for me to think about? I mean, the implications of war are just so horrendous. It's wrecking our economy. The numbers of people all over the world who are killed and injured, the troubles of the veterans. We can no longer just say, well, that's too bad. That's just the way war is. I just commend you for bringing the material together in this book so that people can read it and face it and think about it.
You know, I think that's why the issue of empathy is very important.
Yes.
Empathy is a very basic human characteristic. We have it, or we have it driven out of us, or some few don't have it, and they're the ones we know as sociopaths or psychopaths. And when it occurred to me that what I was trying to do was empathetically engage with soldiers in combat to understand what their experiences were, it also occurred to me that this is how we can read this material and how we can approach it and understand it, because it is who we are as human beings. I think a lot of times in the media, we're getting horror stories upon horror stories and left with not knowing what to do with it.
Yes.
Think if you approach these conditions through what I'm calling a politics of empathy.
Yes.
In this book, you have a way of going at it that engages your own humanity. When I was talking with veterans who have been in combat, seen and done the worst, I realized that the moment I distanced myself and said, I couldn't possibly understand that. I'm a woman. I've never been in combat. I've never hurt anybody. I couldn't possibly understand it. The moment I disengage myself, I've turned away from what you've just said, from what war is doing to all of us. But the moment that I engage with that soldier and talk with him from a standpoint of really understanding and really trying to empathize with the situation that he's in, his humanity comes alive to me. Then I see what the U.S. military has done to him, which is a harm that no human being should ever be subjected to. And when that happens, I'm activated to do something.
Yes.
As opposed to being immobilized by all the terror that is put in front of us on the nightly news.
Yes.
Or in the movies that take the nightly news yet another step further in terror. Approaching it through empathy is bringing in our own humanity. And our humanity is not hurt by doing that.
That's right.
It's enhanced.
That's right. It is enhanced. You open the book with a remarkable story that takes place out on Bodega Bay, and I like the way that you wove that story through the book. You referred back to it. It was kind of a touchstone. Would you just briefly tell the story of the events that took place out at Bodega Bay?
Sure. In fact, you know, I didn't begin the book initially this way. I was writing, and at some point it occurred to me, I have to establish a moral base for this book. And I don't want that moral base to be moralistic. I don't want it to be coming from piety. I don't want it to be coming from anything other than how we value human life as human beings, that's innate to us. It's actually repulsive to human beings to kill another human being. So you have to become somewhat inhuman to kill another human being. So I was at Bodega Bay at one of the beaches late morning, one Saturday morning, and walking toward the beach, we notice a helicopter on the beach. And a friend of mine said, oh my God, somebody must have drowned. Me, in complete dissociation from the event, said, oh no, that's not what's going on. And as we get to the beach, I'm seeing the people around us crying and stunned. You could feel this and see this overwhelming shock in people. A 9-year-old boy had gone into the water. He'd gotten picked up by an undertow. His father dove in after him and rescued him, hurling him up to the beach, at which point the father was slammed under and drowned. And his drowning and rescue is what the people had just witnessed. And what I saw, I didn't realize it at the moment because I was just with everybody else, stunned and in tears and that kind of thing. What I saw was what I'd later called shared human consciousness. These were people who knew nothing of this man or this boy. They were all there on their individual or family, mostly family outings to the beach. But there was something about that drowning that struck everyone so strongly that once they kind of got their wits together, just started packing up their things and leaving. And whenever I've told that story, and I'm sure this is probably true for many listeners, people are shaking their heads. Yes, I've been there. I've seen that. I've been part of that kind of event at some point or another where you're instantly interconnected. You don't know anybody else, but you're instantly interconnected around this loss of human life.
Yes. And I think that occurs also in the case of a disaster. Rebecca Solnit has written so eloquently about this in a book called, I think it's called A Paradise Built in Hell. I may have mangled the title a little bit, but the phenomenon of she writes about the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, that the original reaction of people was to gather together and help each other. It was empathy. It was cooperation. It was, what can I do? What do you need? And there was this wonderful feeling that took place for a short time until a semi-military presence happened, and either policemen or National Guard or some kind of organized group came in and said, all right, we're in charge now, we'll take care of this. And the situation changed completely, and then, of course, things fell apart. And she talks about this also in the flood in New Orleans. And we've recently seen, a number of things on television about the aftermath of the hurricane. And since I was reading your book at the time, I was struck by, as Brian Williams emphasized, these are Americans that are yelling for help. You know, they're hungry, they're thirsty, they're dying, help. And when the military presence finally came in, you see them driving by in their vehicles, stony-faced, refusing to even look at or talk to the people, their countrymen, who are begging for help. And I thought, those poor souls in the military have been so trained to cut off any compassion or any empathy that they can't even look out the window and say, help is on the way, or what can we do, or water will be here soon, or anything. And it was a tremendous demonstration to me of what you write about in the book, the way that men are trained in the military to suppress their humanity.
Yes. And you know, interestingly enough, as you were describing these different events, the same thing happened at 9/11 in 2001.
That's right.
Even though it wasn't a natural catastrophe.
Right.
It was that immediately there was this outpouring of goodwill, and immediately churches and schools opened up, and people came in and started cooking for the firefighters, and counselors were rushing in to give counsel to people waiting to see if their loved ones had survived, and safe houses were opened for Arabs who were, you know, likely to be attacked with racist reactions because it came from Al-Qaeda. And we forget that. We forget that with, for example, this so-called mosque controversy going
yes.
on. We forget that there was this really beautiful moment in the sight of all of the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, you're very right. I think our military has a lot to be held accountable for mm-hmm. to how they train human beings, both mm-hmm. men and women. But right now, even though some women end up in combat, the military does not actually call them up for combat. But yet that training is a training of a dehumanization so that they will be prepared to dehumanize those that they encounter, which supposedly is going to be on a war field. We've heard the same reports from Haiti when
yes.
the military went into Haiti as when they went into New Orleans. They are so trained to treat the other as the enemy, as it's somebody to dehumanize, to, you know, punch around, that in Haiti, it was reported that they've got guns in the faces of people standing in line for food handouts right after the disaster there. And I don't think it's because these military are particularly, you know, at base in a fundamental human way, horrible human beings.
No.
I think that they are subjected to the same kind of thing that cults subject people to, a kind of brainwashing that requires that they lose a sense of their own self. And as soon as we lose a sense of ourselves, we're in deep, deep trouble. The losing your sense of yourself, bonding, therefore, with others around you, losing their sense of their selves. And so the only thing that matters then is what you're collectively trained to do, and that is to protect each other, meaning taking anybody out who might possibly be in danger to the other.
As I read your book, there were times when I just despaired, and I thought, oh, it's so ingrained, you know, how can things ever get better? Will we ever have peace? Will we ever have an end to war? But then I would come back to the thought that the process of turning out soldiers is a dehumanizing, that we are all human. We all have these feelings of empathy, which you described so eloquently. And if it takes all that work to breed it out of soldiers, it must be a very, very strong impulse. And I find hope in some of the most unexpected places. You know, so many people all over the world share the concerns which you express in this book and agree that this is a dehumanizing process and know that this could be better. We can make this a better world. It's not going to be easy to reestablish empathy as a viable means of getting on with each other, but it can be done.
This is why the second half of the title is Remaking Men.
Yes.
My hope comes from the men and women, but in combat it is still mostly men, who have refused to fight, mm-hmm. who have gone into combat, seen what is expected of them, and walked away to great cost to themselves.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Being put in prison and that kind of thing. But to go through the dehumanization that the military puts them through, and to still, that's that spark of human life,
yeah.
to still stand in a situation in Iraq or in Afghanistan and say, I am not going to do this to these human beings, mm-hmm. and refuse and either apply to be a conscientious objector or to go AWOL and simply outrightly resist, is my strongest hope. Because it's come from a place that's far more damaged than those of us who are here trying to figure out what to do about what's going on there. And yet that human spirit comes through. And these men are really, I think, my role models for remaking men. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important to point out that we don't get to remake men unless we take on the U.S. military. We have to remember that General Petraeus and every other general and admiral has been through the same training that these soldiers in combat, that they hold the same values about killing, about taking other people's lives. They give us public relation campaigns for us to feel better about what they're doing, like they're going to go do walk and talks in neighborhoods or something like that. But that's what it is. It's PR for us. What we really have to do is, I think, not only be protesting war, but actually protesting the U.S. military and other militaries, but the U.S., I think, is far more severe than any other militaries as we know it today. Mm-hmm. We need a different kind of military. And in this book, I've been able to conjure up what that would look like.
Yes.
In what mm-hmm. I'm calling a global peacemaking military.
Yes. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is your host, Rosemary Manchester. My guest in the studio is Kathleen Berry, whose new book is coming out very soon. It's called Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. And when we come back, I'm going to ask Kathleen to tell the story of the two young men who set off across the United States with their message of empathy. We'll be right back.
We're going to give this a go. Like I said, this one's for Thomas. And I imagine the planet as a whole.
I speak for a man who gave for this land, took a bullet in the back for his pain, spilled his blood in the dirt and the dust, and he's come back to say that what he has seen is hard to believe, and it does no good to just pray. All he asks of us to stand and we must. With his mind he sin,
no more.
With his heart he sin,
no more.
With his life he sin,
no more.
With his eyes he sin,
no more.
With his body he sin,
no more.
With his voice he sin.
We're back. You're listening to A Novel Idea. This is Rosemary Manchester, your host. My guest is Kathleen Berry, Dr. Kathleen Berry, and her book is Unmaking War, Remaking Men, How Empathy Can Reshape Our Politics, Our Soldiers, and Ourselves. Kathleen, one of the most hopeful things in the book was the story of these two young men. Let me read just a bit as you introduce them. Meet Josh Stieber and Connor Curran, who in 2009 bicycled the United States to talk to anyone who would listen about their path to peace, the contagious love experiment. Beyond their powerful anti-war message, coming directly from their own horrific experiences in combat, theirs is a story that diffuses core masculinity and sparks the creation of something new.
You know, it was really exciting to me when I met Josh and Connor because I was actually writing that chapter, the last chapter of the book. And I had actually just gotten to that point in the chapter where I said to myself, okay, I've interviewed so many veterans and listened to testimony, particularly of so many veterans and soldiers in combat. And I really have a feel for this. I've heard the stories of those who've resisted. But how am I going to present this positive side of these men who actually do something else when they resist? And our very own Peace and Justice Center of Sonoma County, but in Santa Rosa, was having an event that particular day that I was working on this, asking myself that question. And I had the event on my calendar, and it was these two vets who were going to be talking about the contagious love experiment. And I thought, oh, okay, I'll get over there and see what's going on. And they literally wrote my last chapter. Because what they both did was walk us through those minute details of everyday experience, only their everyday experiences were in Iraq, in combat zones, but those minute experiences where change takes place. As a sociologist, but as a human being, I believe very much that we are human because we interact. It's not that we interact because we're human, but that we are human because we interact with each other. And that means that we are making or unmaking our humanity in every interaction we have. And as each of them told of their experiences, which I develop in the book and you can also find on their website, you could see how very small decisions. I don't want to do this anymore. How can I break out of this mindset? I'll do this small little thing to break out of this mindset. And then it worked. And then I could try to do another small little thing. And it's all just interacting with oneself and then with others until you are starting to retrieve your own self, that breaking out of that dehumanization that we talked about earlier in the program. And that's what each of them did and told us the story of how they did that. They didn't know each other in Iraq, as I understand, but met back in the States and were very, you know, harmed by what they had been through, with one of them with PTSD. And in the process of meeting and getting together, they came up with this idea that they would bicycle across the country and talk to anybody who would listen to them. And they kind of got handed on from one peace and justice or community action center to another, you know, so people would hear about them and then, you're coming our way, come to our town and do this. And so they did that for the better part of a year. And they really are beautiful human beings who just convince you that what the military does to these soldiers can not only be undone, but it can be really made into something quite beautiful. And in fact, as a postmark to this, because it happened just as I was finishing the book, when the WikiLeaks came out with the story of the journalists being killed by American soldiers, the Iraqi journalists being killed, it was Josh Stiber, along with one of the soldiers who was actually in that event, who wrote an open letter of reconciliation to the people of Iraq that was published in, well, probably not our major newspapers, as we know how that news gets filtered, but published all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was not only a letter of apology, but a letter of seeking reconciliation with the understanding that Iraqis have no reason to want to be reconciled with us with what we've done to their country, but it really showing that goodwill. So these men have become kind of a signal of a whole set of new values, along with Iraq Veterans Against the War, and there's some women soldiers networks that are doing similar things.
Yes. And I think that a new attitude is forming about soldiers, about servicemen. In the Vietnam War, you know, I was in Women's Strike for Peace, and I fell into that trap of blaming the soldiers. Mm-hmm. Of course, it isn't that they are blameless, but they were dehumanized before they did the things that they did. And I think we were probably not very effective in taking out our anger against the servicemen themselves. And now we've had a generation to think about that. We can see how the dehumanization takes place. And it's to me, it's a much more open and helpful attitude toward veterans. They have suffered in inflicting great harm on others, and the extent to which we can reach out to them and find those of them who will respond, I think that can be helpful to us as well as helpful to them.
You know, you bring up a really important point about the way we responded to veterans during and after the Vietnam War. What appalls me about our government today is they've gone exactly the opposite direction, skipping over the fact that what's actually in reality happening in combat. They go to honoring the veterans, honoring soldiers for their service, no matter what they've done. Mm-hmm. That is appalling to me, treating the veterans as fully responsible for what the military put them into. And I think there is this other path, because after all, we do have to be held accountable for our actions. And these veterans like Josh and Connor, who are out on these kind of campaigns, as well as Iraq Veterans Against the War, are not going around saying, give us honor and give us recognition because we didn't do anything wrong. They're saying we did horrible things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this has to be made right.
Mm-hmm.
Our government and our military is skipping over that whole point.
That's right.
Because once we look at that, mm-hmm. then we have to look at them and say, mm-hmm. you got to go.
And that's always happened in history. As soon as the war is over, who cares about the veterans? It's crazy the way that happens over and over and over again.
That's one of many reasons that I refer to masculinity as being built on what I call expendable lives.
Yes.
Of men learning, growing up, that they may have to serve in combat and therefore may have to die when they're 19 or 23 or 21 or 27 or 42, die, quote, before their time, as we use that phrase. There's something really heinous in our socialization of boys to becoming men, that we allow them to learn or even partially in any way believe that they could be made expendable.
Yes, yes.
And that's the beginning of the dehumanization.
That's right.
And that's something we could stop instantly.
Yes.
Because that's what we do in socialization,
yes,
of them.
And we've only had time to just touch on that in our interview. And I encourage people to read the book, because that whole concept you developed so carefully and you document it so well, the gradual realization that the reader has through turning the pages of your book and saying, yes, that's true, I hadn't thought of that. And then the incremental effect as it builds up. And I mean, nobody can say this isn't the way it is. It just hasn't been, well, I'm speaking for myself, it hasn't been pointed out to me so carefully before so that I recognize it. Let me tell you about my own little ritual that I go through to remind myself about war. On public television, the Jim Lehrer's program, at the end of many of those programs, they show pictures of the soldiers who recently died with their names. And I know people won't watch that because they say, oh, that's just too much, I don't want to see that. Nevertheless, they're gone. You know, their names come on, and I look at their faces and I think of the ones who are left behind, who are mourning them because of the nonsense of war. And I think it's not right. So, Kathleen, thank you for taking the number of years to write this book.
Four years.
Thank you for those 4 years, because it's so carefully done, and there's such love in this book. There's not blame in this book, unless it's blame for the system, but it's not blame for the people. And what you've done to show us the power of empathy, and for us to dig down, find that empathy, or you don't have to dig far, it's right there, and let the empathy shine. And it does. You know, there are little, talk about points of light. The peace and justice centers all over the world are shining for empathy.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Mm-hmm.
It's really true.
Yeah.
Just a kind of little postscript.
Yes.
I know this program and the kind of roll call of the soldiers, mm-hmm. who were killed. And I also watch it and I think about, you know, there goes, mm-hmm. brilliant scientists,
yes.
and, you know, wonderful humanitarians,
yes.
and
yes.
all kinds of, and artists and, mm-hmm. writers, all kinds of possibilities in, yes. these human beings. But I also think about the 1.3 million Iraqis.
Of course.
That don't get rolled down our screens.
That we don't see.
And that we don't
or
see.
Or call their names.
That our government never even bothered to count the numbers of the killings.
That's right.
And then the sobering really takes us in. And I think it's important to say that, well, I'm very engaged with empathy for the soldiers in this book. I've also tried to really engage with empathy for what the experience of being in Iraq and Afghanistan under the U.S. military invasion and occupation.
Yes, and I want to assure our listeners that in no way does Kathleen neglect to show the suffering of the people whom we call collateral damage, or, you know, we have all kinds of euphemism for, we call them the enemy.
The insurgents, the enemy,
right.
The collateral damage. We've got all kinds.
Yes.
And now there's the, Petraeus has come up with reconcilables and irreconcilables.
Oh, dear.
Language keeps getting more remote, more dehumanized.
Yes.
Anything to keep us from thinking of them as human beings, just like us.
Just like us. That's right. Kathleen, I so appreciate your coming in. And you have several public appearances in the near future. On next Sunday, October 17th, in the afternoon from 2:30 to 5, you are going to be at the Sitting Room in Cotati to talk about your book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men. The Sitting Room is at 170 East Cotati Avenue in Cotati. You don't need to make a reservation. You can go on the website for the Sitting Room and get exact directions and learn more about it. You can go to Kathleen Berry's website, which is kathleenberry.net. kathleenberry.net. Now, that's easy enough. And then you have other appearances scheduled as well.
Yeah, and at 7 p.m. on Thursday, October 21st, I'm going to be speaking at our own Peace and Justice Center here in Santa Rosa on Sebastopol Avenue. And then on October 24th, Sunday afternoon at 2:30, Code Pink is doing a San Francisco book launch for this book at the Women's Building. That's in San Francisco. So I'm very excited about these events as they're starting to happen and occur. The book isn't even out yet. It's going to be available on Amazon by the end of October, but it will be available at all these events.
Yes.
Because these are celebrations, book launches and celebrations of the publication of the book.
That's right. And it'll be in the bookstores very soon.
I am looking forward to it myself.
Yes, so that people can have their own copy. Kathleen, thank you so much for coming in today. This is something that needs our thought and our care. And we can fix this. We can find our better selves and go on from here. I'm convinced of it.
I might just add that I'm just starting a blog on my website to continue the discussion of politics of empathy that I've raised in the book, taking it through controversies as they're coming up now since the book has been completed. So
that's going to be lively.
I hope that people will join in the discussion.
I'm sure they will. Conference of the Redwood Writers Club is coming up the end of the month. Linda Loveland Reed came into the studio to talk about it with Suzanne Lang, who produces the show.
Linda Loveland Reed, you're here to talk about the Redwood Writers Conference that's coming up on Saturday, October 30th at the Flamingo Hotel in Santa Rosa with a poetry eve the night before. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Before we actually launch into talking about the Redwood Writers, some of our listeners may recall you were on the show within the past year to talk about your book, Touch of Magenta. But you're also a painter and a theater director. And tell us a little bit about yourself and what drives you a little bit.
I think I'm driven by the artisticness of the various areas that I get involved in, something just kind of grabs me to create something, whether it be on stage, which as directing theater is very creative. And I'm going to be directing The Ticking Clock for 6th Street Playhouse. So that's going to be great fun because it's Women's History Month, and we're going to have an art show by women. So any women who have art they'd like to display in the lobby, please get a hold of me. And we're going to also bring on people who are non-actors at the end of each performance so that we can get a dialogue with the audience. And Lenny Dean's going to help me out with that. So it's going to be a very exciting time. And in terms of painting, I'm not painting quite as much these days because I'm so involved as president of Redwood Writers, which I'm very pleased to be doing. And, of course, I'm still trying to get some writing in there, too.
So you're involved in some very collaborative things, both in theater and as president of the Redwood Writers, but yet some solitary activities as well with your writing and painting.
Yes, and it's a nice balance. You know, to have your private moments, of course, we all need those, but to interact with so many creative people, whether it's that they're, you know, trying to think of their latest Pulitzer Prize winner or they're practicing their lines to get on stage. And in fact, the Redwood Writers right now has a contest running that's open to the public. So all of you out there who would like to take your hand at writing a play, it's 10-minute play contest, and send it in to Redwood Writers. And you can go to the website, redwoodwriters.org, and find information, and we'd love to have you participate. And we're going to produce those plays as a fundraiser, so it's really going to be a big event.
That sounds great. Now, tell us a little bit about the Redwood Writers in particular.
This year, we celebrated our 35th anniversary. Redwood Writers is a branch of the California Writers Club, started over 100 years ago by Jack London, and so we've carried on over all these years. Our branch right now here in our area is the second largest in the state, and we meet the second Sunday, usually, so it's good to check the website to be sure, but the second Sunday of each month at the Flamingo Hotel, and we invite you to come. It's an exciting place to be for a writer, whether you're doing fiction or nonfiction or biography or memoir or a poet. We just had a wonderful poetry contest. You are welcome, and you will meet other writers. You know, writing can be solitary, and to find a family, a community of people who are doing what you're doing. And by the way, people think, do I have to be published to be a member of Redwood Writers? Absolutely not. It may be that you just want to write for yourself. It may be that you're writing and you're sending your work out to try to get in publications. It might be that you're writing that novel. Whatever you're doing, there's a place for you at Redwood Writers, and you're going to find friends that are going to inspire you.
And you have, as you said, meetings, regular meetings, and workshops. And so that leads us right into the upcoming conference.
Yes, we're very excited about our conference. This is our second conference. Now, these conferences are a big deal. For instance, sadly, two of California's big conferences, mainstays, East of Eden and Jack London, were canceled just weeks before they were to go on. And it's because of the economy, and those conferences had gotten large and expensive. Our conference is not expensive, so again, you want to go to the website, www.redwoodwriters.org, and you may register for the conference. So we have two things happening. On Friday evening, October 29th, it's totally devoted to poetry. And what a wonderful, wonderful, marvelous evening that is. And Gwen O'Gara, our poet laureate here in Sonoma County, is going to lead us in that evening. We also have a poetry contest, and the winners will be announced that evening. And that is $35 for dinner and an entire evening. Then the next day, the conference, and it runs all day, and it is going to offer many, many seminars all day long on various types of information that people need who are writers. I want to mention Marlene Cullen, who is our chair and has been for the last 2 years, and just marvelous, and Karen Batchelor, who works with her, and Rob Kowalski, who does our PR. And the conference, our keynote speaker is Alisa Southard, and she is accredited by the Public Relations Society of America and is often quoted as saying, "Don't kill a marketing moment, execute it." So you can kind of tell what her speech is going to be about. And then the afternoon keynote speaker is Sheldon Siegel. Sheldon writes mysteries featuring Mike Daly, and he has sold millions of copies and been translated into 8 languages. And he is a wonderful speaker. And we also have a contest open for anybody who's registered, and that will be a prose contest. So if you're registered, you can send your submission in. There'll be lots happening.
So this is geared towards writers, and as I perused the agenda during the day, it really is a broad range of topics covered, whether you're writing for children or writing for a memoir or trying to do character development or plot development. So it really could be a primer for you, a very, very good tool if you're either a new writer or just trying to hone your craft.
Well, you really picked up on that. It has to be broad because we have such a broad constituency to serve. People who are interested in so many types of writing, and so we want to serve all those needs. So why come? Well, we're going to talk about the do's and don'ts of writing and how to research nonfiction if you want to be published. Do you self-publish? Do you POD? Are you going to go to a traditional publisher? Are you looking for an editor? We're going to have information on the tech side, which of course is important for every phase of life now. Do you have a website? Do you want a website? How do you use it? Do you blog? And just basically, how do you use the internet to get what's called in the biz a platform? So you're going to learn about that, and we try to serve as many areas as we can.
It sounds like a really rich day, and it's over there at the Flamingo Hotel in Santa Rosa. And, you know, you mentioned technology plays a bigger and bigger role in publishing these days, and the print-on-demand, the POD, as you just mentioned. And we recently had Buzzy Martin on the show, who self-published a book, and then it went on to be picked up by a major publisher. And certainly that doesn't happen all the time. So it sounds like this conference is a good venue for encouraging writers who may be stuck or don't know where to go with their work.
I think that that is a really important issue because I take myself, for instance, when I found Redwood Writers, I was writing my first novel and I really didn't know anything about the industry. So the things that I needed to find out, which I did, and I went on to publish very soon after I had joined them within a year, I needed to know, what is this editing thing? You know, how do I go about that? What should I pay for that? Should I pay for it? Do I self-publish? What does that mean? What's the difference between that and what's really going to happen to my book if I decide to self-publish and get on with it instead of spending the 2 or 3 years it might take me to get an editor, to get an agent, and then have that agent get me a publisher? So these are questions that you need to understand in the business of writing so that you can go forward intelligently for yourself. And these are the questions that you're going to see a lot of subjects at the conference that will help you tap into what should I do? And then there's the inspiration of writing, the motivation. You might think, well, if you're a writer, you don't need that, but you do. And one of the reasons is that little word called rejection. Are we good enough? Is what I'm putting down on the page today worth anything? And you need to be motivated to keep going and write that novel.
And it seems like part of the whole notion of the Redwood Writers and the California Writers Club is to encourage one another and support one another in this endeavor. And it does seem like everybody has a story to tell and everybody's writing.
That's right. There's so many writers. It's exciting. Our motto at Redwood Writers is writers helping writers. And we really, really do that. For instance, every year we publish an anthology, and this year 43 of our members have their work published. And every year we offer that opportunity. Our anthology is called Vintage Voices, and this year it's got a tack onto it called Words Poured Out, and you can go on the website and get it for a mere $12. In that same vein that you're talking about, we also offer ways for our writers to read their work, to get up, to be in public. We do that through various libraries that we have readings. And so you can bring your work and you can read every month. And we also have salons and private homes. So this is where you can read your work privately in front of other Redwood writers, meet each other, maybe form a critique group, which is very, very important to writers to get that feedback. And then right now we have our library outreach, in which we're working with Alice Carmack at Sonoma County Library, and we've put together a series of panel discussions in which our members are serving on panels and going to the various libraries. And you may come for F-R-E-E, free, to these panels and enjoy discussions about how to write and all the things we're talking about here today. So we hope you'll go to the website and find out those dates of those panels. They're now all the way through February.
Fabulous. That's at the redwoodwriters.org. And so let's wrap up with talking a little bit more about this conference that is on October 30th in Santa Rosa at the Flamingo, with a poetry eve the night before. That sounds like a good evening, $35 to get in and have a good dinner and indulge in some poetry there. Yeah.
Last year was the first year that we had our conference, and we also had the poetry night. And I came away just floating. It's wonderful to spend time listening to poetry being read by different people. There's just nothing like it to put your mind and your body and your soul in the right place. I feel the same way when we go to these readings and I listen to our writers and they're up there and they're reading their work. And it doesn't matter what it is people who are trying to create, who are releasing this wonderful bug they have in them, and we're sharing it together.
And ultimately, that's what you're doing, is getting it out and in a safe environment to share your work. Because if you're wanting that larger exposure, you eventually have to put yourself out there, and it sounds like a safe, supportive group to do that with.
Those words are so important, and you've got it exact, that we do want to create that environment and then help that person to move out into the public, to begin reading publicly, to get bigger ideas about maybe what they want to do. And we have many published authors, great successes. To me, a success is everyone who's writing.
Very good. So there are many seminars during the day on the 30th, and are some of them simultaneous, so you might have to make a choice?
Absolutely. There's lots of choices, which is can be a good thing and also be a bad thing because you want to go to all of them. And we begin in the morning with 8:30, and we have our keynote speaker in the morning, and then we go right into sessions, and then we break for lunch with another wonderful Sheldon for our keynote speaker there and lunch, and then go back into sessions all day. And then at the end, we have a wrap party. Again, it's free, and where we can just, you know, network and mingle and just celebrate. So it's a good time, and the price is right. And I hope that everyone out there who aspires to writing, is interested in writing, maybe you're a reader and you want to know how people write, please join us.
And you don't have to be a member to attend the conference. You have a good website that tells who all the speakers are and what's happening during the day. So I hope our listeners will take heed and go to that website, redwoodwriters.org, and register for the conference October 30th at the Flamingo.
I hope so, and I hope to also see you at one of our regular meetings. You will find them very entertaining, lots of fun, and who knows, you might even decide to join us.
Thank you, Linda Loveland Reed.
Thank you.
And that's our program for this evening. I want to thank Kathleen Berry for coming in to talk about her book, Unmaking War, Remaking Men. Thanks to Linda Loveland Reed for filling us in on the annual conference of the Redwood Writers Club. Thanks to Suzanne Lang, who produces the show. And remember, everybody, there's no such thing as too many books.